How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success.
I've been telling everybody that our government is shady. But every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens invading.
And they don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with
this
your...
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
Over the course of 80 years, in a lifetime of learning and teaching, a Platonic Academy was established in its founder's name, whose works have endured since his time of death in 348 BC. The absolute miracle of this body of work transcending entropy and lasting into our time, arguably impacting the Western world like no other philosophy, affecting humanity in the past 300 to 400 years in a most profound way, tracing its way through the minds of leaders and thinkers, each who contributed to fan and feed the great hermetic flame, a flame which burns only the untouchable, an indivisible side in all of us, a formless fire deep within Western civilization. And joining us to embark on a journey to greater understanding is Ike Baker, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast to discuss his new book, A Formless Fire, Rediscovering the Magical Traditions of the West. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with Ike Baker.
Euripides wanted to write a beautiful play, you know, or any other playwright, they prayed to the muses, come, inspire me, come into me and give me the vision. That's how they did it. There's another thing that's poisonous to our community. They never attributed brilliance to themselves. They said, the muses work through me. It's not me, it's the muse. That's why in the ancient past, you could have these beautiful, profound dialogues, and the author just said, written by Hermes Trismegistus. He didn't have a fucking PR agent. He didn't have a website and he's trying to, you know, gain clout and brand. No, it's not about me. It's about the message that's coming through me. And these people were more able to deliver these messages because they could get themselves out of the way. Now, again, I talked about how the ancient Egyptians were studying nature and how a lot of what they taught the Greeks was a natural philosophy. So I wouldn't say we want to discard the material world, but I would say that we want to put it in its right place, which is that we need to investigate the material world with the understanding that there is something spiritual and immaterial that creates it and influences it. And that is ultimately what we're trying to know through the material, right? Because materialism isn't just the study of matter. It's the idea that only matter exists, right? So we don't want to do that.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here we are back again on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And with us today is a returning guest, someone who's been on the show before, and they are fresh off of a very spectacular trip that we're going to learn all about. The host of the Arcanum podcast, Ike Baker, returns here with us today. Ike, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Please remind the folks anything that I left out in your introduction, and maybe also give us a little breakdown on where you just returned from, because this is exciting stuff and I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Sure. Well, Mark, I'm glad to be back. Thank you so much for having me. The last conversation we had on your show actually was one of my favorites. I'm happy to be here. Yeah, I've been very busy. I am the host of the Arcanum podcast and YouTube channel. I'm the podcast host there, but I also create documentary-style presentations on the history, theory, and practice of the Western esoteric traditions, because I am an initiate of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn and Freemasonry, Martinism, all sorts of stuff. I put together the 2024 Southeastern Masonic Symposium in Asheville at the Masonic Temple there. And yes, I was a co-host and co-organizer, co-founder of the first ever Hermopolis Symposium at the New Hermopolis Village with my co-organizer and co-founder, Dr. Mervat Abdel Nasser. She created the New Hermopolis Eco Village to be a standing monument to the ancient wisdom, practices, building styles, native flora of ancient Egypt. And she did this 15 years ago, or over 15 years ago. And we hosted the first ever symposium that's been held there. It was a collection of the top scholars in the world on the field of Western esotericism and religion, as well as some of the most praised and active and important practitioners of Western esotericism. So alchemy, astrology, ceremonial magic, things of that nature. So we sequestered everyone for 4 days in the middle of the desert. Really, we were very close to the ruins of the ancient Egyptian, Greco-Egyptian city of Hermopolis, which was the city of the scholars, the city of Hermes, and the city of the Ibis. So we also did, on the fourth day, a group excursion to Hermopolis, Hermopolis Magna, as it's called. And so we also had a digital track. So we didn't have an in-person audience because the space was too remote. The vibe was not right for that. And also we didn't have the logistics on site to be able to host that many visitors. So what we did was we invited a host of people who couldn't travel, unfortunately. And so they submitted digital presentations. I mean, incredible presenters. Roger Calliste, Peter Mark Adams, Ronnie Pontiac, Marlena Seven Bremner, fantastic contributors. And so they submitted digital presentations, which we aired. And we will be airing on the weekend of November 23rd, the on-site proceedings, which include presentations by, for people that are familiar with Western esotericism, Dr. Walter Honegraaff from the University of Amsterdam, his groundbreaking work. I mean, he's at the forefront of the study, the academic study of Western esotericism. Dr. Gregory Shaw, who really needs no introduction, Dr. Shannon Grimes, Dr. Aaron Cheek, Dr. Charles Stang, he's the head the director of the Harvard Center for the Study of World Religions. So maybe when I come up there and visit you, we'll pop by and see Charles. But many, many excellent scholars and many fantastic practitioners like Robert Gordon, Jamie Paul Lamb, Soledad Davies, who runs Psicosomatica, the only Spanish-speaking institute for the academic study of astrology. So P.D. Newman also was there in his work on the entheogenic component, the ancient entheogenic component of initiation and ritual, and his work is brilliant as well. So it was really a fantastic thing, and we have all the presentations that we are airing for $90, $90. We seriously undervalued this thing. For $90, you can have 6 days worth of presentations. Everyone's presentation is available for unlimited viewing for the term of 1 year until we have the next symposium, which we are planning to do. So I'll give you the link for that, and people can go and check it out and see if it's going to be worth their time. I think it will be. So that was truly an historic and life-changing event. For me especially, but I'm sure for everyone else as well.
I love that. And remind me and the audience what website they can go to purchase the entire symposium and all the presentations within it.
Yes. Yeah, so it's we have a website called, well, it's Hermopolis-foundation.org, but the actual site where you're going to go to buy and purchase these digital passes is patreon.com/thenewHermopolisConference1. And I will send you a link to the shop there. So patreon.com/thenewHermopolisConference1. No spaces.
Right on. And now, this isn't the only thing you've been up to. You're a very busy guy. You recently released your first book, right? Which is A Formless Fire, Rediscovering the Magical Traditions of the West. A, how do you have time for all this? And B, how long have you been working on this book?
I make time, man. You know, the thing is, the term of research that went into the book. I mean, it's over 138,000 words. It's almost 500 pages long. There are appendices, right? So at the end of the book, there are, I think, seven or eight different appendices, which give you practical instructions and commentary on how to make a spagyric tincture of mercury. The alchemist out of Canada, he runs Secret Fire Apothecary. His name is Daniel Wiseman. He helped me put that together. The Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram, the Middle Pillar Exercise, how to consecrate and make essentially holy water for blessings and purification. That's all in there. But the thing is, the term of research has been the last, you know, 19, 20 years of me being in these communities and doing this, putting this at the forefront of my life. So a lot of the information was already there. So I just had to kind of write it out. And I should really look this quote up because I quote it all the time and I quote it incorrectly. I butcher it. But you get the point of it. It was, I think Mozart said something to the effect, right? Paraphrasing that if I waited for inspiration, I wouldn't finish a single composition. So I don't wait to write. I sit down every day and I force myself to write. Now, the thing is, you know, people that are familiar with writing or, you know, people who aspire to be writers or even full-time writers now are like, yes, it can be very difficult. The thing is, I'm not writing fiction, right? I'm writing what we consider nonfiction, philosophy, and technical sort of manuals. So it's the information's already there. It's just about sort of contextualizing it, organizing it, and presenting it. So I think it's a little bit easier because I don't have to be inspired to write, but when I am, that arguably it gives what I really do believe my work, my literary work, it gives it my thumbprint, my creative sort of, I like to blend sort of a kind of poetry into the way that I write, even though I'm presenting history, theory, and practice, because I just think there's something more to literature and the exchange of ideas that has to be also beautiful. And in that way, it touches something transcendent, right? Nowadays, we're used to like these very weird PowerPoint kind of bullet point, it's that way of teaching and learning. And I truly don't think that it is effective. I think that people are becoming way more clever and they're able to sort of contain within their head all this rote information, these dates and names and facts, but they are stripped completely of the heart of the thing. They have no poetry, which does not stimulate the soul. And the things I'm writing about have to stimulate the soul. So that's kind of my method there for that. But I wrote actually two books at the same time because I got two book deals and I was like, I can't. Yeah, I'm going to do both. You know, so I wrote A Formless Fire. I always had a cup of black coffee and I just had a nice loaded up pipe full of tobacco. And I just sat there like a freight train chugging away. And it was beautiful and bloody and glorious at the same time. And I had a lot of help from my editors and from particularly Jake Traer and Jamie Paul Lamb, my publishers. You know, Jamie wrote the foreword to the book, which was incredible and scathing. Beautiful work. And Jake really helped me hone in on what the hell I was doing. Focusing, presenting so much information. How to present it. What's the context? What's the purpose? What's the why? And what's the voice? And Jake really helped me with that. So I did have help in kind of molding it and honing it. The other book is going to be coming out. Llewellyn Publisher is putting it out April 8th, and it's called Etheric Magic, A Complete System of Elemental, Celestial, and Alchemical Magic. And essentially my years in Chinese medicine and energy work and body work, things like that, Taoist inner alchemy, that kind of stuff, Qigong, Reiki. I studied a lot of energy work. And we know from the Greek record and from the Egyptian record that this kind of energetic, this light body, right, this avgoedi soma, they called it in ancient Neoplatonic Greek, the egg-shaped body, the luminous vehicle, the okima pneumatikon, the spiritual chariot. They were working with these things, but we don't have the practice anymore in Western esotericism, but they have it fully in esoteric Eastern systems. So my training in that plus ceremonial magic, I was able to synthesize them and essentially systematize and create a system of energy work for the Western esoteric practitioner that can be applied to magic and alchemy and things of that nature. And I use the verbiage and the symbolism of alchemy and the Kabbalistic tree of life. And that those are kind of the Western esoteric symbol systems, the vocabulary that I use to, you know, grid map and teach how to use, how to sense energy, how to see it, how to move it, how to cultivate it and use it for purposes of ceremony and ritual. So that'll be out April 8th.
Wow. Fascinating. I'm looking forward to that. That sounds incredible. And I love the synthesis of that Eastern medicine sort of subtle energy focused practice with the, and it's hard to say more materially oriented because that's just the surface level, but you know, Western esotericism tends to be at least skewed towards that from our perspective now as modern people. But I don't necessarily think that that's always been the case. And that's why I'm extra delighted to have you on the show so we can get into the origins of the Western esoteric tradition, because that is a part of your book, A Formless Fire. And I think when it comes to this, you know, people tend to think back to something like the Bible as the oldest, maybe pervading narrative in our Western culture. And while that may be true in a certain sense, esoterically speaking, Plato's work and those who came before him and followed him, I would argue, have equally influenced the Western culture. I don't think that this is an argument that necessarily needs to be made. I'm sure it's acknowledged by many, but I'm curious, your thoughts on that and where it all begins, because I remember when you were on Tinfoil Hat a couple weeks ago or so on, it was, you put it to Sam and the guys like, well, this guy, I think it was Socrates, had a student, and that was Aristotle, and then Aristotle's student was Alexander the Great, and then, you know, this is a continuation of a certain tradition. So yeah. Let's get into that. Let's start from square one, and I'll ask questions along the way. But where do you think we need to take the needle back to fully understand Western esotericism as it is today?
Right. Yeah. So it was Socrates who taught Plato, and Plato taught Aristotle, and Aristotle right. taught Alexander the Great. And then Alexander goes and conquers the known world at the time. And the synthesis, when Alexander conquers Persia, because Persia had controlled, they had occupied Egypt for almost 200 years, just about, and they were not pleasant. They were overlords. They were foreign occupiers. Whereas, you know, a lot of people want to kind of get into this, what I think is, can I swear?
Please do.
I think it's fucking bullshit, this kind of like this colonizer thing of that the Greeks did to the Egyptians. They were at the fucking mercy of the Persians, who were just stomping on their heads. If you listen to, like, one of the best ways to learn about Persian history and Sumerians, is go listen to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. I mean, it's like listening to Dan Carlin talk for 5 hours is like watching one of the greatest movies of all time, except there's no visuals. The way that he explains it is like it's a movie of the mind, the theater of the mind. It's beautiful. But he does this thing on you know, Cyrus and the Akkadian rulers. And these guys were fucking disgusting. You know, they would conquer their enemies, remove the head of the king, put it in a cage or a jar, and hang it in their bedchamber, and then take the king who they conquered, the wife, and then force them to have sex every night with their dead husband's head in a fucking cage looking at them. These people were sick. Like, historically, I don't know what it is. Genetically, there's something up here where they were vicious, vicious, cruel human beings. Cyrus or Kirosh the Great, right? The one who sends the Hebrews out of Babylon and back. He says, go build your temple. You have my support. He's called Cyrus the Great because he's the only emperor of that time, the only ruler who's merciful. And he was great. He was a man of wisdom, like Solomon himself, according to legend. But you've got these kinds of rulers. Alexander came in and did them a fucking favor. He did him a favor. And he reinstalled the Pharaonic dynasty. When the Persians conquered Egypt, they said, you have no pharaohs anymore. Of course, Alexander then installed himself as the pharaoh, of course. But what was he going to do? You know, and not only that, but he went and paid respect to them to show you, like, look, I am going to sort of honor your ways. He goes to Memphis, the chief city, and he makes sacrifice to the Apis bull. So Alexander, right, who's the golden child, I mean, he's basically a god. He's the considered like the son of Zeus or Ares at the time. He's a personification of the hand of God for all intents and purposes. And he says, I'm coming in and I'm going to worship. I'm going to pay tribute to your god. You know, so he had respect and he had love for the Egyptian culture because the Greek civilization that he loved so much and wanted to spread everywhere, they made their bones from the Egyptians. They were taught everything they fucking know by the Egyptians. And it's tested throughout the Greek record. Solon, Thales, Pythagoras, Plato is attested in a certain record to have studied under a priest of Horus, a Horite priest named Sekhnoufis in Egypt. You know, all the greats. So there's this Egyptian-Greek kind of relationship, this kind of reciprocity. And so by the time of the Hellenistic period, which is about, you know, 332 BCE, up until the time where Rome conquers it at about, I want to say 40 or 60 BCE, that Hellenistic synthesis, where we see the beginnings in Alexandria, Egypt, particularly, but also the greater Mediterranean, Phoenicia, Syria, Tyre, all these places, Greece itself. At the time, you know, mainland Italy was not what we think. You know, it, for like something like 500 years, it was called Magna Graecia, Greater Greece. Italy was Greek for a huge component. That's where Socrates' settlement of Crotona was. It was in Sicily, or no, it was in the southern southwestern coast of Italy. So that whole area was permeated and penetrated by this stuff. But that's that period in time is when we start to see the early modern emergence of alchemy, as we understand it, the early modern emergence of astrology, as we understand it, and the early modern emergence of ceremonial theurgy, which is the tradition of magic that has come down to us in esoteric orders. There's another kind of magic called goetia, which is sorcery, necromancy, things of that nature. That doesn't come down to us in any kind of systematized way because it's dirty magic. It's dark and it's self-invested, very, very self-invested. So a lot of modern people, especially very, you know, overly educated people who learn themselves stupid, I like to say, they'll find a way to kind of, you know, equivocate and justify and rationalize. Well, if I can, you know, use a spirit to get money and this person's out of money and I give all the money to them, well, aren't I helping them? Well, no, because you're not taking the karmic considerations you're exercising your power and your ability and inflating your own fucking ego. And at the end of the day, you're not taking into account this person's karmic journey. Does it really help them? You know, one of my favorite quotes is the only type of charity worth giving is the kind that allows the recipient to become independent of it. You know, so you need to be able to learn hard lessons as part of life. So a lot of the the philosophy and mental gymnastics behind this sorcery is bullshit. I'm not afraid to say that. I scrap with plenty people in the you know, magical communities about that stuff. I'm never going to be on board with any of your horse shit, but it's just what it is. I practice the higher magic. That's all it. You know, I'm not trying to enrich myself and aggrandize my powers and inflate my ego and show everybody what a magus I am. Rather, I'd like to pay what I have been given forward and show people the systems that I have inherited that can assist them in developing spiritually in a practical and efficacious way. Hmm. A lot of people are really, really interested. They feel that itch to evolve. But where do they go first? They go to the internet. And the internet, my friend, is a fucking sewer. It's a sewer. My first 4 years in initiation, I didn't have social media. I didn't go on the internet. I burnt all that shit by fire. You know, burn the fleet. And it had a purifying effect on my consciousness. I learned what it was like to become human the way that thousands of years of humanity was before me. And it connected me with that way of seeing the world. And if you can't connect with a pre-modern or at least pre-postmodern way of seeing the world, you'll never do magic. It transforms your mind, your consciousness, and your way of being in the world. And if you are unwilling to let that go and you keep taking this ancient worldview and trying to shoehorn it into your postmodern worldview, you're going to mangle it. It's not going to work. And a lot of this is done unconscious. We call it unconscious materialist bias, right? Because a lot of the way that we look at the world is factory installed now. It's factory settings, you know, and what initiation is trying to do is destroy that by fire. So if you're not willing, and you get a lot of people that say, well, this resonates with me, or this doesn't resonate with me. And good. How are you supposed to grow if it feels good? If it already, you know, you're not supposed to understand this shit. If you understand it, it's not going to expand you, right? Like if it's not, you know, like you're trying to buy clothes that fit and lose weight at the same time, you need to, you know, you need to be uncomfortable for a little while until you transform yourself. So all of this, you know, this is the way it is in the modern paradigm, but all of it really starts. We know that it starts in Egypt, and we know that there's even some version of it in the ancient Mesopotamian civilizations. Much harder to find. They don't let us in there, right? There's not a lot of cooperation with Iran right now and Iraq. You know what I'm saying? So archaeologically, there is a good amount of source material. A lot of it we have to pull from mythology, because now we're getting to a point where it's just post-shamanic. And so the shamanic astrotheology is encoded in myth. So we really, our best bet there is to look at myth. And if you, once you know how to interpret mythology, across the board, you can transpose. And so that's also what we have to do with Egypt. Although the difference between Egypt is that Egypt was conquered by Greece. And what's one of the many benefits of that? Well, we move from hieroglyphic to hieratic to demotic, and then finally to Coptic, right? Coptic is what we can read and understand best, because it's mostly the Greek alphabet with a few letters thrown in to adjust for Egyptian pronunciation, things that Egyptian people did with their palate that Greek people didn't, Greek-speaking people. So the Coptic records and the hieratic and the demotic records, which are more alphabets rather than pictographs, tell us a little bit more. You get things, you know, like the Nag Hammadi, all that stuff, right? Coptic, Greek. And you get other things, you get hieroglyphics, you get a good mix of all of it. The Leyden and London papyri, the Ebers papyrus, the Metternich stela. You get all these kind of things that are left, and we get to see what they were doing, what they were saying. There's systems of metallurgy, there's systems of herbalism, there's systems of surgery, medicine, I mean, astronomy. Very, very, very hyper-sophisticated and very busy culture. And it's really the Egyptian priest class are the first philosophers. They teach a natural philosophy, a method of discursive and logical investigation with that mystical component, right? It's very important. They teach that to the Greeks. And the Greeks develop it. And, you know, the Greek mind is closer to our mind. You go back and you look at the ancient Old Kingdom Egyptian, or even the late Old Kingdom period, when they start putting hieroglyphics in the tombs and things like that, you see a sort of mythological way of thinking that we don't really fully understand. But the Greeks essentially create what we consider, you know, discursive grammar and syntax and all that stuff. So we can read the Greek stuff a little more easily than we can interpret the hieroglyphic stuff. But what we get really, the two main traditions that filter in are the Parmenidean tradition, and that has to do with Parmenides of Elea, and the Pythagorean tradition, which everybody knows, right? Pythagoras of Samos. These things kind of meet and have their convergence point in Socrates, and are expressed, you know, because Socrates didn't write anything, expressed through his student Plato. And the Platonic dialogues and the Platonic philosophy becomes the philosophy. And from there, we have the Middle Platonic era and the Late Platonic era, which we academically call the Neoplatonic era. And it's from this era that we develop. We have Plato's philosophy and cosmology and metaphysic and his epistemology, right? The study of what can and can be known, and why or how, right? And then we receive a sophisticated form of practice. We're beginning to practice the metaphysic. We're beginning to practice the cosmology. And that practice, there are two trains. They're known as theoria and theurgia. Theoria is sort of more meditative, contemplative, more akin to Buddhist sort of ways of transcending the self, the material self. And then theurgia or theurgy is a ritualistic way of generating supra-rational states that impart gnosis by way of henosis. And henosis is a term that means union with the divine. So we unite with the divine in these ecstatic states through ritual. We come back down into our regular bodies, and we now have some sort of spiritual knowledge that transcends words. So philosophically, there is sort of less epistemological investigation and more of a defense, particularly by people like Iamblichus, the third century Syrian philosopher, a defense of theurgy, you know, a defense of the practice. And that generates, for me, right, that entire body of wisdom, if you really look at it, that's where Christianity comes from. It comes from the Hellenistic, that is Greco-Egyptian influence on the Jewish population. Because if you look at Alexandria in the first century, what we're talking about here, right, where all this shit started, all these records go back to, the population of Alexandria at that time was 40% Jewish. And we see a body of literature called the Merkaba literature, which is Jewish theurgy. They're doing what the Greeks did. They learned what the Greeks did, this ascent to the heavenly spheres and trying to go on to the, you know, past the material universe and look at God, you know, be before the throne of God. This was Neoplatonic, this or Platonic theurgy, Hermetic theurgy. And the Hebrew population had learned it. And at that time, they translated their scripture into Greek. Okay, that's the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew scriptures. Okay, and so we see this Greek influence on the Hebrews that becomes Christianity. Now, a lot of Christians don't want to talk about this. And it's mostly because they're just fucking afraid of losing their identity, losing their dogma, losing their theology, and losing that. That's what Christianity does for most people. People who are religious but not really connected to why they're religious. They just want to be fucking right. They want to be on the quote-unquote winning side, the right team. And you'll see, like, it's Sam's audience is big on this. You know, he's got a lot of kind of these strange fundamentalist Christians that follow him. And of course, those are the most vocal people, but they refuse to look at the fact that Christianity developed in this way. They absolutely, they cannot bear it. It's like they physically can't handle it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. First and foremost, I'd like to remind you that you're not getting the entire episode. Yes, there's a whole part two, an entire second hour of this conversation with Ike Baker, and it's ad-free and interruption-free when you sign up for just $5 on the Patreon or the Substack for $8. That's $5 a month or $8 a month on Substack, patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. You get this episode and every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast in its entirety, ad-free and interruption-free, along with bonus episodes. So go over there and sign up right now, and we'll be right back to this episode with Ike Baker after a quick break to our dynamic ads. All right, folks, this ad is for the men in the audience 30 and up, so skip ahead if that's not you. All right, guys, listen, don't be ashamed if you can't keep it up in bed. Maybe you're smoking too much pot or drinking too much liquor. If that's not holding you back, there might be another issue. It could be something that you're being prescribed and it's causing dysfunctional erections. Well, that's no good. We don't want you suffering from that. Hims is here to help. Their over-the-counter product might be the stealthy solution to your cock confusion. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments, all from the comfort and privacy of your couch. Hims provides access to a range of doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, proven treatments like Viagra and Cialis, or their generics for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. You don't have to visit a doctor. Just answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free. No insurance needed. Pay one low price for your treatments online and start your free online visit today at hims.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/crazy. The products mentioned are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Check out Hims and use my code CRAZY for a great deal. www.hims.com.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm so glad you brought that up and punctuated that point, because it's become such a theme with me and Tinfoil Hat. You know, as the booker, it puts me in a precarious situation where I may take the blame for a guest's anyone opinion or whatnot. And yeah, it does give me a strange reaction. And that's why I so very much appreciated your conversation with Sam and the guys. I don't know that it would get through to the most fundamental of us, because those folks aren't looking to have an open mind, and they can't admit that they're wrong. And Sam said it himself, you know, he doesn't want to be right. He wants to do right. And what do you need to do? Admit when you're wrong, right? Or admit maybe when you don't know. And that is so refreshing of him to say. And I think, you know, as a fan of that show, that's where I follow Sam's lead in many ways. But yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it was one of the things I wanted to highlight on this show, where we don't have that same fundamental element, you know, fundamentalist element. But then again, my show's much smaller, so I probably do have it by a certain percentage. It's just, you know, that whole vocal minority concept where... Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's the loudest of the least of us, right? But yeah. When it comes go ahead.
The main thing that I've encountered on almost every podcast in the milieu in which, you know, your podcast situates itself and Sam's podcast situates itself. And it's funny, because the hosts are completely open-minded to almost everything. Wonderful, generous, intellectual, philosophical, big-hearted people to talk to. Yet for some reason, there's this audience that follows the podcast around and is very, very vocal about the hatred of Freemasonry and Freemasons, and think that, like, yeah, he's a Freemason, why wouldn't he tell the truth? And it's like, it's tough, because, yeah, everything that comes out of my mouth, those people don't even realize that they're fundamentalists. And I told somebody... You know, somebody wrote something and they were like, you know, this guy didn't even really hit on any deep knowledge. You know, he's talking about not seeing anything funny in Lodge, but tell him to explain how the symbolism of the Twin Towers isn't mirrored in the Twin Towers of Freemasonry. And I basically said, look, first of all, they're pillars and they're biblical. So they predate 9/11 by probably 3,000 to 5,000 years. So if we're going to just project whatever the fuck we want onto Freemasonry because you need a scapegoat and you're probably a fucking incel, then why don't we include the twin two towers from Lord of the Rings? Throw them in. You know, the two towers from the Garden of Eden. Keep them on the pile too. It's that kind of simpleton's research that allows the real power players to grab the worst parts of the masses by the neck and direct them at whatever target they want.
Right.
So I told him, if you want some deep knowledge, my friend, you are the PSYOP. You totally are. You have no fucking clue what you're talking about. You have zero clue. And the thing is, if you really wanted to learn about this shit, you would join the fucking orders, you know, like I did. I joined these things to kind of figure out what is this. I didn't believe in magic.
Yeah.
I wanted to see, are these people controlling the world? I'm going to write a book. I'll expose it all.
Right.
You know, and you know what I found out? I was with the good guys, and it blew my fucking mind.
Right.
You know?
Well, and what's interesting about my research into New Haven and Skull and Bones is, like, I'm not going to paint them into the same corner as Freemasonry. I think they've actually kind of been oppositional in some ways to Freemasonry's goals and ethics from what I've learned. But yeah, it is really distressing as people who are open-minded and want to have these conversations to move the needle forward to see those sort of fundamentalist reactions coming from the same people who would watch a meme that says, oh, well, look, the Simpsons television show predicted 9/11, but they don't turn around and say, oh, the Simpsons, everyone who wrote that show is evil. They're an evil cabal. Matt Bronger, he's a sorcerer. He can predict things, but they'll do that for the Freemasons because there's this historical precedent, these political charges that have been slewed against them many times. And I think it's in many ways an attempt for the old world hierarchy of the royals and the elites, the dictators, the feudalist fundamental fascists, take your pick of F words. We just call them fuckers on this show. But when it comes to American Freemasonry, what I'm most familiar with, it seems like the Masonic panic of the 19th century, the early 19th century, had outliers or people on the outside who might have been creating that situation to disintegrate America's powerful community-oriented structure that, yes, maybe favored the families that were a part of it, but I mean, that's what any community would do. It would favor the people who are directly connected to them, right? So there are cases to be made that Freemasonry has been attacked in this way because it is a powerful influence on society that counters what, you know, maybe any dictator or fascist would want, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Call them an oligarchy, call them a corporatocracy, whatever you want to call it. Their goals go fundamentally against what Freemasonry espouses. So yeah, no, it's frustrating. And as someone who's not a Freemason, I still can sympathize and relate to it because through my research into American history, like, we wouldn't have our Constitution, we wouldn't have our freedoms and our fundamental God-given rights established in the way that they're established in this country. And keep in mind, every other country in the world, when we did that, was like, oh shit, they're the ones, right? And how many countries we've affected by doing that? Like, people really just shit all over that whenever they make these sort of allegations about the Freemasons, which, as you pointed out initially, are really uneducated. The people who are making these points are not coming from an educated place. And I think, you know, they have a point in the sense that academia has become so stuffy and stifled that it does feel like we're being lied to at massive levels, and people want to find someone to blame, right? So it's an easy thing to fall into this scapegoat logic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, that's the best way to know that you're working with the worst parts of yourself. When you become part of a fucking angry mob and you say these people have to burn, you know, something has gone horribly wrong in your soul and in your heart. And that is what fundamentalism is. is saying we are the good guys, and so we're allowed to think and do and wish bad things because the bad guys don't deserve any murder. Meantime, you have no fucking clue. You have no clue that it's your thoughts, emotions, intentions, and actions that make you either good or bad. Not what fucking team you're on, not what flag you're waving. You know, so these people who are convinced that they're on the right side actually end up becoming the fucking bad guys, embodying, expressing, and enacting evil in the world. If words are powerful, you know, like even if you never strangled or killed anybody or well, because that's the thing, right? The rise of fundamentalism and anti-Masonic hysteria in the past year has, they've thrown bricks through our lodge window. They've shot a Mason down south as he was leaving the lodge and killed him. They've firebombed the Scottish Rite in Greece. You know, like this is a serious attack against Masonry. And these guys are your average fucking Joes. These are the guys that are coming with the jaws of life as an EMT to pull you out of your fucking car wreck because you're drunk driving. You know, like it's like we're, don't get me wrong. I argue with my brothers all the time. They're people. And they're not all the most educated people. I would say the overwhelming majority of us are blue collar, you know, and not necessarily educated.
Right.
But I know enough as a Masonic historian. That's my job for my lodge. I am the installed Masonic historian for Mount Hermon 118. And my job as a Masonic historian is to know the context and to know that there have always been multiple Masonries, the way that there have always, since the beginning, been multiple Christianities. You know, the Grand Lodge of England was arguing with Ireland and Scotland. Scotland arguably was doing it before the English, right? I mean, and that's why the French started putting all together all these Scottish rites, these Scottish degrees. Scottish stuff that you see now that's called Scottish Rite is French in origin.
Right.
Because the French were like kind of cosplaying. They were putting the word Scottish in front of their Freemasonic degrees and rituals to give it a sense of, you know, authenticity and age. Oh, we're Scottish, so we're much older than the Grand Lodge of England. Get out of here with that shit. Mm. You know, this is the real stuff. This is the esoteric stuff. So there's never been one Freemasonry. You know, I don't have to lick any English boot. I don't want to. I go over there and I hang out with my English brothers. They take care of me. I have friends all over the fucking world. If I need help, they will give it and not ask anything in return.
Right.
You know, they are you are a brother, you are a brother. But you know, like the idea that there's some strange cabal that we're all privy to and that all of us are doing these weird satanic rites is like I just, it's difficult to talk about because of how frustrating it is. Like my lived reality is not enough for people. You know, I get it. I guess I'm a stranger on the internet and I'm on, you know, I'm in the Freemasonry camp, but I'm telling you, I mean, there's nothing else I can do. You are going to die a paranoid fucking nightmare wreck of a human being if you keep going down this Freemasonic evil satanic rabbit hole. Anybody can do a ritual and call themselves Freemasons.
Right.
Anybody can do this, that, or the other thing. Anybody can tell you about how their uncle was a Freemason. He was a shady guy and he used to, I don't know, do weird things in the barn across the field, you know, but at the end of the day, it's like, that's not Freemasonry. Your uncle might have been a piece of shit, but that's not Freemasonry.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's the same thing, you know, with any group of people, whether it's a religion, a political organization. I mean, you can take any group and do an ad hominem attack or say, oh, look at this one bad example, and it still doesn't spoil the bunch, right? So I think that's the emphasis here. But I'm curious, you know, given where we started and how we got to this point in the conversation, what sorts of groups were around in the time of Socrates and Plato? Because we talk about mystery schools on the show, and I think mystery schools sometimes are derided in the same way by these fundamentalist types, where they cast them as like orgies, psychedelic orgies of some kind. And I think that, you know, it's one of these topics that's so nuanced and hard to understand, especially considering that it is in essence, sacred and almost like, I think, you know, one of the things that really, when I initially became curious in all these topics, one of the first ideas that was sort of dawned upon me was that these secret societies, maybe they're not so bad. Maybe they're actually preserving this perennial philosophy, this ancient stream of information and knowledge. And, you know, I've weighed both options a lot. You know, when you look at a lot of the political things that go on, it's easy to scapegoat these groups and these strange, you know, groups that have had influence on history. But yeah, I'm curious, you know, in Plato's time, like what were the mystery schools, if you know, to take yourself back to the mind of a Greek in that era, you know, maybe that's a feat too far. But yeah, what are your thoughts on maybe Plato, even his response to these fundamentalists? Like how would he have treated fundamentalists in his time?
Well, Plato was smart because Plato basically, he used Socrates to rail against fundamentalists. A lot of Plato's dialogues actually are a really, really harsh, scathing, and aggressive attack on a group of people. And those people were the sophists. He hated them. Now, there's an argument, right, in Plato's seventh letter, which of his collected letters is largely or academically agreed to be probably the only authentic one. Or at least that's what most scholars agree. The most amount of scholars agree that that one is authentic. Plato basically says the philosophy of Plato has never and will never be written down. The dialogues are Socrates made beautiful. But you got to think if this guy's writing dialogues, right? He's not on a word processor like me typing some sort of, you know, 15-minute bullshit blog. You have to write this stuff on. With quill and ink that you have to make from berries and things like that, you know, and some sort of mollusk, you know, like
very
it's
finite
not easy.
Resources. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not easy to like write dialogues. So at that point, so a lot of thought goes into it, but he was a devout student. He wrote very beautifully and poetically, also realistically about his teacher Socrates. And he was a student of Socrates until Socrates' end. Right. And the state puts him to death. Actually, the state tells him he has to leave or die. And he says, fuck you, kill me. So Socrates was a badass, really. But Plato was with him to the end. So you have to imagine that he absorbed and appreciated most of his philosophy. You know, nobody can spend that much time with somebody and devote so much of their life to this figure and not in some way agree with them or at least appreciate their viewpoint. Socrates rails against the sophists. He basically says, he's like, you know, they're worse than useless, you know, and he uses sophistry as a contrast against philosophy so that we can learn what true love of wisdom is, not rhetoric, not debate for the sake of debate, not debate for the sake of winning, but true philosophy, which always, always admonishes us to do the right thing, even unto death. Why? Because we believe in the immortality of the soul and that what we do here is reflected in the afterlife. We receive a series of rewards and punishments based on what we have done here because of the way the soul becomes conditioned by its experience in materiality. That is the way of philosophy. Now, this is thought to come out of the initiations that the Greeks underwent in Egypt. So you didn't really have very many, or at least well-known mystery cults, the way we would conceptualize them in Plato, you know, today in Plato's time. You had priestly, hieratic cults. They were priests of Asclepius, priests of Dionysius, priests of Zeus, priests of Demeter. You had the Eleusinian mysteries. The Eleusinian mysteries were public. You had the Samothracian mysteries, right, up in Samothrake. They were public. You had really the things that were not public, that were kind of like what we would consider a secret society, quote unquote, were the priestcraft stuff. And they were investigating the mysteries of a particular manifestation of nature, which they called the god, right? The ancient Egyptian word for god is Netcher, That's likely the etymological root of our word nature. Because what were they studying? They were studying nature. And they called it, this is this God. This is this God. It's just as natural to them as any scientific fact is to us, or law is to us. They just called it a God. And when they talked about it, they had to anthropomorphize it because they didn't have a sophisticated scientific vernacular the way we do. That was their scientific vernacular, was to think about it and talk about it in parable and analogy, because to their brains, these were the four walls in which they had to work. They didn't have any other way of talking about it. But they saw the world in a similar way, but it was filled with noumena, because they believed that whatever we see here is ultimately a product of something from the other side. So, but it wasn't this kind of primitive idiocy, you know, that we think it is. It's just their way of talking about natural processes, which really, if you think about it, are a miracle in and of themselves, right? Because modern science basically says, give me one free miracle and I'll explain the rest. You know, it doesn't ask why. It asks how or what, but it doesn't ask why. And these people knew you can't fucking ask any questions until you figure out why.
Right.
You have to know, or at least keep asking, keep trying to know the why. Yeah, and the why always points to something beyond us and there being a reality there, a true reality. So that's how they ended up having a holistic worldview. And this was carried out mostly through the priestcraft. The exception we have to mystery cults that we can think of is that there are these little schools like Plato's Academy. According to Aristotle, Aristotle didn't mince words. He was an empiricist. He didn't talk floridly. He didn't talk mythologically or very grandiose. It's kind of boring. I say what I mean. I mean what I say. He mentions in two of his, you know, most prominent works, the Physic and the Metaphysics, he mentions what is called the agrapha dogmata of Plato, the unwritten doctrines. So he's referencing there are things Plato never wrote down. And we know that as initiates of that school, but I'm not going to tell you about it. You know, I can't tell you about it. That's not written down. It's not for me to say. So there's that in the Platonic school, but then there's also similar things, like quasi-shamanic sort of thing in the Parmenidean school, and particularly anybody who's even remotely interested in Western esotericism or sacred geometry knows that the Pythagorean school was really the first, as we understand it, well-known mystery school. That was, you did not have to be a priest, but you can initiate man, woman. They lived a communal lifestyle. For 5 years, you didn't say a word. You just listened to what was said. We're not having, like in the Platonic school, a democratic discussion. You go, now I go. You listened to the elders and you kept your mouth shut for 5 years. And they called it, they said you kept a pebble in your mouth. You hold a pebble in between your lips. You don't say anything. And they were involved in intense geometric mathematical mysteries that get transferred to the Platonic tradition. The Platonic tradition carries them through in things like the Timaeus. It gives us a Pythagorean explicitly, right? It's called the Timaeus because the chief speaker is a Pythagorean named Timaeus, who's telling us about how the creative deity of the universe, like an architect, laid out the world in terms of geometry and then put a soul into it. Very Pythagorean, very mystical. Modern magical societies like the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, most people don't even know this, but there's Pythagoreanism all over it, all over it. There's Neoplatonism. Lines in the Golden Dawn ritual out of Neoplatonic texts, multiple of them, but also of the New Testament. From the canonical gospels in the Golden Dawn rituals. You know, so because there's Neoplatonic language in the Gospels, you know, the Christianity was a mystery cult when it started. So in Plato's time, we don't know much about these mystery cults like we understand them today, right? Because we see a lot of bullshit on Instagram and all this stuff, and a lot of people quoting those 19th century and 18th century orators who wanted everything to be a mystery school. They wrote with rose-colored glasses on. They were very, poetic about history back then. This wasn't a bad thing because it stimulated the imagination. It broke us out of our kind of, at that time, rigid scientism was becoming a thing. It broke us out of that shell. But at the end of the day, we can't really know much about actual mystery schools. But what we do know is that the Pythagoreans had a mystery cult. They transferred it to the Platonic school somehow. The school of Parmenides, very much an epistemological, right? So involved in the study of knowledge. How do we know things? Why? They had this main central doctrine around this idea of being and non-being and this paradox. This is the Parmenidian paradox, the being and non-being. How can they both exist at the same time? And that gets transferred to the Platonic school. And again, there's an unwritten doctrine. There are things that they're learning, that they're speaking about, that are codified, that are laws, right? Because he says dogmata, not axiomata. Dogmata, that means doctrine. That means this is a doctrine. We believe this. And he's talking about it. It's oral. He's not writing it down. Aristotle parted with Plato in so many different ways. He got rid of all the metaphysical stuff, and he set us on the path, really, towards postmodernism, nominalism, and hyper-rational Cartesianism. So for him to admit, explicitly mention the fact that there's shit that he told us that we can't tell nobody, you take that seriously from a source like Aristotle. So there was something going on there, but all of it really is revolving out of, for lack of a better word, either the Egyptian kind of priest class, or there are other more oriental, like Scythian, and even perhaps, Indo-European influences that are somewhat shamanic, that are penetrating into Greece. The Greeks were a seafaring people. They were invested in trade and all things. So they traveled a lot. They had a lot of interactions with a lot of different people. And they were not people who said, our way is the right way. We said, oh, looks like you got something going on over there. That looks pretty good. Let's bring that god into our pantheon. So they collected a lot of the knowledge of the known world.
As we wind down and wrap up here, Ike, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I definitely want to open the doors for you to be on the show whenever you please, if you have something you want to talk about. And then the other way around, I might be bugging you about coming back on the show to get more specific, because we did speak generally about a lot of things today, and I love that. We kind of covered a wide range of topics, and folks who are curious to dive deeper obviously can go and check out the Hermopolis Symposium and all the lectures that comprise, all the presentations rather. Lectures makes it sound a little too stuffy. They're presentations and very interesting ones. If you remember any of the names that Ike listed off at the beginning of our show, only a few have been on this podcast, but all of them are people I'd like to get on this podcast. So go and check that out, folks. A Formless Fire, Rediscovering the Magical Traditions of the West. This is Ike's first book, but you have a second book that's coming out later next year, right? So
April.
Yeah. Remind people where they can follow you, where they can follow you on social media and whatnot, if you still have that. I know you said you weren't on social media for a long time.
Yeah, this was years ago. Okay, good. My first initiations were a long time ago. So, but I've gotten back on to try and do this work of offering an alternative opinion, much like yourself. And, I think podcasts like yours, it's the reason I'm here, is because the work that you're doing is noble, because you do have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And you do have, and it's worth it to investigate these things, because any of the stuff that I railed against is not stuff I don't believe in. I believe that there's life elsewhere. I've seen unidentified flying objects. I've seen what I know it's spacecraft. I have used DMT and experienced those sort of geometric entities. I have had these, I've done it. I've seen it. I believe in it. But the difference is I think we go down the wrong path when we grab onto that and say, I have found the truth. you know, it's like you're saying, you got to constantly remain open. And I love that you do that as a host. You bring on guests, you present these things, but you're leaving room for interpretation. You're bringing on guests that maybe have contradictory viewpoints. So that's the important thing in this kind of like podcast sphere that we're in today, where, you know, there's a thick, dense shell of very superficial stuff. And so I love what you're doing. I'd be happy to come back on here anytime you want to talk. It's an honor and a pleasure. And you can find pretty much links to all of my work on the Arcanum podcast, the latest video of the documentary series, which I believe is part two of a history of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn that has been very well received. I've got my latest podcasts up there, my blogs, links to where you can buy my book. We don't want to do Amazon unless you're outside of the United States, because Amazon pays authors pennies on the dollar. And my publishers and the work that I put into this far, I think should retain its value. So there's a direct link to buy from the publisher, and the shipping time and price is comparable. So there's that. There are links that on that page where you can go and buy the New Hermopolis passes. And so you can find all of that at ikebaker.com, ikebaker.com. You can follow me on Instagram at Arcanum with a V. I've got periods in between each letter. A little complicated, but you'll find me. You'll know me. I'll pop up in your algorithm. One thing that I do want to mention is there's a little form on my webpage, and you can reach me directly and immediately. I might not respond immediately, but I get all those emails straight to my personal phone right away if you want to reach out and talk. I get a lot of people that want to talk, and that's great. I'm very, very – I'm privileged to have that. But to be respectful of my time I do half-hour consultations for free, and then I take on private students. I do have a roster of private students. Right now, with the Tinfoil Hat podcast and a podcast I did recently on the secret teachings, I don't think I have any room for new students. But, you know, it's always kind of a little bit of a revolving door. And if you want to reach out and discuss things with me, again, like I said, you get half hour with me for free, and then I have to charge for my time. But you have one-off questions, things that you want to, hey, you want to tell me to piss off? You want to tell me I'm wrong? I'm all about free speech, man. You can go ahead, put it in the chat. So you can reach me personally on that form on my webpage, ikebaker.com.
Awesome stuff, man, and I definitely will be reaching out, and hopefully we can get you out to New Haven, and when we do, we'll definitely put something together. I'm working on, I have all the materials necessary to start doing in-person interviews and things like that, so yeah, if you do make your way out here, it will be, we can document something for sure and share it on both of our platforms. But either way, always great to connect with you. Thanks again for making the time. And for folks listening, thank you for being here. Big special thanks to all the people who are listening on the supporter side of the show and got the entire conversation. If you are only hearing half of the conversation, sign up on Patreon or Substack, and you'll get the full juice as well as bonus episodes and all sorts of other good stuff. But until next episode, we'll catch you next time. Immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our conversation with Ike Baker. Go and check him out at ikebaker.com and the Arcanum podcast. But that was not the entire conversation. If you want the full episode of this My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast episode with Ike Baker, our second time talking here on the show, well, you got to sign up on Patreon or Substack. That's patreon.com/mftic or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com. And for $5 a month on Patreon or $8 a month on Substack, you'll get an exclusive premium RSS feed that basically has every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast in its entirety, ad-free, interruption-free, plus bonus episodes, and you help completely support me in my endeavors in doing this podcast twice a week. Sometimes more, like this week where we did three free episodes. So Thank you for being here. Thank you for tuning in. Leave a 5-star rating and review if you love the podcast. I will be reading those for Thanksgiving, a little bit of a Thanksgiving special. Going to give thanks to all of you folks who listen to the show. So look forward to that. I'll be live streaming that on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/myfamilythinksimcrazy. And big shout out to all our sponsors, the Hit Kit, promo code crazy to get 15% off. They've got a ton of new designs. We've got rawoptics.com/crazyoptics for 10% off your blue light blocking lenses in very stylish frames. You can see me at My Family Thinks I'm Crazy on Instagram wearing my own pair of Raw Optics. And of course, Brain Supreme is my favorite microdosing option. That's brainsupreme.co to check it out. And Adam Schell, the founder of Brain Supreme, will be joining me very shortly on the podcast with a very special deal for all of you listeners. So go and check that out while you can. brainsupreme.co, promo code crazy15. And we will catch you next episode or in the part two of this conversation. Go on over to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast on patreon.com/mftic to continue with this episode. And until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. MFTIC.
Broadcast in the moon matrix from the lunar surface. They want you confused like you never knew your purpose. Hopping through the portals, dismantling the machine. My family thinks I'm crazy, I can't believe what I've seen. Memories of a war, the Pleiadians and Anunnaki. Stuck within the genes of a copy of a human body. DNA fractal, the universe within me. Epiphanies of science is hoarded by the Illuminati. Puppet masters know the power of the mantra. Repeating mad lies till it has an effect on ya. Subliminal messages hijack your perception. Tricking the population with holographic projections. We see through it, the system is unraveling. I'm astral traveling through the library of the Vatican. On a sacred journey, I embark with the squad. Forever spitting truth like Mark on the pod. Gotta know the facts, never hold back, cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade. I awoke in a deep underground military base. Zero recollection of how I got to this place. Alien corpses floating in glass cylinders. Must have been extracted when they crashed into us. Animal hybrids contained in the cages. A lion with the eagle head. Monkeys with reptilian faces. Losing my mind and I'm feeling desperate. I look around the room and I see no sign of an exit. All of a sudden the wall flickers away, revealing a hangar full of spacecraft. My getaway, I run to the nearest one. See a guard knock him out, robbing for his plasma gun. Hop in the ship, take the controls. They highly intuitive, I figure it out easily. Lift off, accelerate through a tunnel until I see the light. Fly into the sky, get flanked by 6 F-35s. Gotta know the facts, never hold back, cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.